this is a session titled Ending Poverty, Is It a Hopeless Dream or a Realistic Possibility? And the paragraph that was underneath it on the board was, Minnesota recently created a legislative commission on ending poverty. Other states have engaged in initiatives to end child poverty or cut poverty in half. Is it possible to end poverty? Why hasn't it been done? And for way of background, I'm John Marty, I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate, and I actually happen to be a co-chair of this legislative commission on ending poverty, giving a number of talks this week on a number of political things. I think one on special interest money in politics, one on the whole direction of vision in politics, and then just a general discussion of politics in general on Thursday. But again, this is question ending poverty is one that we've heard for years. People want to address poverty. Our country's made a number of stabs at doing so over the years. Probably the biggest two were during the New Deal in the 1930s, where we put in a whole package of social compact legislation, a commitment to take care of people in their old age and disability through Social Security, through wage and hour laws to make sure people are paid a minimum wage. A number of efforts to address poverty in the 1930s made a major turnaround in the economy at that time from pulling us out of the Depression. And then in the 1960s, we declared a war on poverty, and a number of new initiatives in healthcare, from Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for low-income people, and a whole range of programs like food stamps and a wide expansion of what we were doing. Some point in the 1960s, we surrendered and poverty won, the war on poverty. And since that time, we've been slipping backwards. 30 or 40 years now, governments in the United States and in each of the individual states have been sliding backwards. Housing, the federal government backed out of very significantly, and states decided it was too expensive to do. Welfare, in the last two or three decades, we've had something that's always been an undercurrent, but it was much higher in the 1980s and 90s, and that was that welfare is received by lazy welfare cheats, and so it was real easy for federal and state governments to cut. And that one, that's still an ongoing issue. I remember a couple of years ago, I was actually campaigning public housing, a project in my district, a small group of townhomes that were public housing, and I talked for a minute or two for a guy in one of the units and went on, and a few minutes later he came running down the street to catch me. Yeah, he wanted to talk to me more. And he said, we got to do something about the welfare we're wasting money on. And I said, you mean like public housing? Oh, no, not like public housing. And he said something about, I think his kids participated in the Women, Infant, Children Nutrition Program. And I said something, you mean like the Women, Infant? No, not like that either. Well, what do you mean? Well, like, it was aid to families with dependent children. Now we've replaced it with other programs, but it was welfare cheats, like the people who lived next door to him. And why were they cheating? Well, he knew they were lazy. He wasn't lazy, he wasn't anything else. He just was somebody else who's cheating the system. But we have those attitudes continue. Tax policy has become much more regressive. The income tax at one time at the federal level was as high as 70% rate, and it's now about half that. States, Minnesota had a progressive tax code, meaning the higher your income, the higher you would pay in total state and local taxes. Our state now has the distinction of being the least regressive of all the states, because no state has a progressive tax code. We may have it on the income tax, but every other tax, cigarette tax, sales tax, property tax, are all heavily the other way, that the lower your income, the more of your income you're going to be spending on taxes. Minimum wage and some of the efforts to make sure people have decent living wage have faded in the last 30, 40 years, so we're going backwards. Who's filled the gap? Well, churches and nonprofits have tried to do so. When I mentioned how the federal government's cut out of housing efforts in the 1980s and 90s and this decade as well, in the 1980s, before Reagan took office, I don't think you could find anywhere in the country a church basement that was being used as a homeless shelter. It wasn't that we didn't have a homeless problem, wasn't that we didn't address it, but that we didn't have shelters, but it tended to be people who were the chronically chemically dependent people, people with chronic mental health issues, street people, people who couldn't, we never did a good job in addressing their needs in society. So we had things like Dorothy Day Centers and Salvation Army types of programs for shelters for people. But you didn't have working people in homeless shelters. You didn't have families and children in homeless shelters. And they weren't so common that every major city has church basements with homeless shelters. So the churches and nonprofits have tried to fill the gap with homeless shelters. Every year you keep hearing about new record levels of use for food shelves. You hear various kinds of what we might have once called soup kitchens, congregate dining programs, programs for feeding people at homeless shelters have been growing in numbers. And we're seeing that what was once seen as a gap-filling thing has become part of the government efforts. In Minnesota, the state now provides funding for food shelves, public money to help subsidize food shelves because we don't have any other way for people to get food. So we try and fill the gap that way. All over society, all over all the generations, we've talked about ending poverty. In the Bible, some people use Christ's words about to the woman, whether she should have used the fancy perfume on him or whether selling the money and giving it to the poor. And Christ used the line about how you will always have poor with you. Implying that he was not going to be with them all the time, but that's been used to say, oh, you're always going to have the poor with you, what difference does it make? And probably until the last century or so, we really didn't have a chance to end poverty because society didn't produce enough wealth for everybody, certainly not everybody on the planet, to have enough food, enough of basic necessities. Earlier in human history, people had to spend their entire lifetime trying to get enough to survive on the basics. But our society's not at that level anymore. The other day I told a story about how I looked last year, look up how much you can spend money on a Rolex watch on, and I saw $19,000. I just looked the other day, and SwissLuxury.com, you can buy a Rolex watch for $57,000. If you want to get the cheaper version, the simple version, the same watch, I assume it's the same watch without the jewelry, it's only $19,900. This watch is, I'm guessing, $25 or $30. I've had it for enough years I don't remember how much it was, but it was probably 1/1000th of what you can buy a Rolex watch for now. And that's not because, it's basically because people have the money. Not everybody, but there's a percentage of the population, enough that it makes sense for a company to sell $20,000 watches. And it's a question then of how we as a society want to spend money. Do we care enough about addressing an issue? When in state governments, we always have budget surpluses and budget shortfalls depending on the economy that year. But do we truly have, the last time we had a big budget surplus in our state, we gave major tax cuts, which have been causing problems ever since then. And it was a question, did we have a surplus? Well, schools were saying they didn't have funding. We certainly had homeless people in Minnesota. Our roads have been struggling for many years. The bridges falling down in our state are not something that happened overnight. It's a number of years of neglect. But we determined that we had a surplus in our budget. So that's a political decision you make, because government has the ability to collect money, and it sets the tax rates, has the ability to spend money. And so if we set the tax rates too low, or if we spend too much, we don't have enough. If we spend too little or collect too much, we have a surplus. But that's a political decision we have to make. And to show the decision, I think I may have told this story last week, but there was a state official in Minnesota, former finance commissioner, who was traveling around the state hyping the need for education funding. And he talked about how his father was one of 11 or 12 kids, low-income family. He was in the school band in a Minneapolis high school, didn't have the money for the saxophone he played, so the school loaned him one. They didn't rent it to him, they loaned him one. He had band uniform provided, he had free music lessons provided. Our kids were in high school, if you wanted music lessons, you paid for it. That may not be a shocking story to you, but he said that was during the Great Depression. Our society had no money for anything, yet we were able to pay enough for our schools to have the equipment, the facilities, the supplies, the tools, the programs that needed to provide a quality education. So that was a decision somebody made then. If our schools don't have money, and it was me with the minors earlier and junior minors, and a lot of them were talking about, one of the things they did talk about was schools being cut and budget cuts, and how they're cutting athletics, they're cutting music and art programs. That's not because the community has no money, it's because we make choices that's not our priority. We'd rather spend money on other things, which include luxurious items like very expensive watches. We make choices in society, and one of them is that we don't have the money to fund schools. Likewise with poverty. We could afford to do so, there's the money in the economy to do so, we have to make the political decision to do so. I'd like to make the case, and I'll talk about this a little more on Wednesday, that we are just coming out of about a 40-year period in which our political system has thrived on people making appeals to fear, to appeals to self-interest, to greed, to dislike, distrust of other people. I think we're ending that time, and I think we don't know what the new era is going to be, but I think there's been a backlash because they overreached in what they were trying to do, and it was mean-spirited in many ways. And the faith community has been speaking out. When I talked about how churches and other nonprofits have been trying to fill the gap with low-income programs, I was at one forum about 2 years ago. A woman said she volunteers weekly and has for years at a food shelf. And one of my colleagues, who's a former grocer, was talking about how in their community they get all the leftover food and everything goes to the food shelves, and how wonderful that was. And she, I think, surprised the guy by saying, you know, she just finds it really offensive that we have to have a whole separate chain of free grocery stores for low-income people because they don't have the money to shop at the regular grocery stores. And he was kind of taken aback because isn't it good enough that we are stocking food shelves and so people at the end of the month, if they run out of money, they can go there every 3 months and get a week's supplies or 3 days worth of supplies or whatever. He thought that was doing a good job, and she, as a volunteer in one of the food shelves every week, she said she found that was the wrong way to do it. And in Minnesota, like in other states, faith communities started saying, can't we do better than this? And they pushed, actually it was the Lutheran Synod in St. Paul that started pushing, they started an ending poverty initiative, and they started asking why the state won't take a look at how we could address poverty. There was a commission on poverty 30 years ago in Minnesota. Why don't we try that again? And they pushed and they came up with a proposal that actually became law in Minnesota, and that was to fund a legislative commission, a commission made up of legislators to study the issue. And the title of the commission is kind of awkward, but it explains what it does. It was a legislative commission to end poverty by the year 2020 in Minnesota. A long name, but a very descriptive name. We're not the only state that's done this. I've heard, I think there are now 11 or 12 states that have commissions, something of this sort, or task forces that are looking at ending poverty. Most of them are a little less ambitious goals, ending childhood poverty or cutting the poverty rate in half. I believe the British government is a nationwide 20-year initiative to cut the poverty rate in half. So ours is a little bolder and so on, but I think that's a lot better. I argue that that's a good task to try and set a broad goal and address it, because if we care about other people, if we don't want people to be in poverty, we ought to say we're going to try and end it and map out how we're going to do that. So I've been on some commissions over the years at the legislature. You get appointed to some of them whether you really want to or not, because somebody created the commission. We need members to serve on them, and I've served on them. But I always have this distrust of them because they often spend many months of working and studying an issue, and they issue a report, and the report gets filed on a shelf. And that's sort of the expectation. Sometimes, well, you know, we'll come up with some legislation out of it, and maybe we can pass part of it. And so that was my attitude about it. I wasn't enthused about it. My wife suggested that this one could have a chance to be different because nonprofit community, faith community, were really believing in it. They thought it could make a difference. If there was a lot of community buy-in, maybe it could make a difference. It was worth trying. And I think I knew she was right because I actually got some emails and phone calls from constituents and others saying, John, would you be willing to serve on this commission? Never had anybody, nobody pays attention to these things, and here people are asking me to serve on it. And I did, and I ended up becoming the co-chair of the commission and excited about the prospect that we're going to actually take a look at how we end poverty in Minnesota by the year 2020. My first reaction to the title and the goal of 2020, when it came up about 2 years ago in the legislature, the year 2006, our legislative session, there was $500,000 appropriated for this in the Senate legislation, the House budget bill didn't have it in. So we had a caucus meeting and one of the issues came up was this. The author of the provision said, you know, he really hopes we can fight hard to keep that provision in there because the House didn't want it. We think it's important to do. And then we started talking about what was the number one issue of the 2006 session, and that was building a new baseball stadium for the Minnesota Twins with 400 some million in public money. So I raised my hand and was eventually called on, and I asked what I thought was a simple, obvious question. That was, why couldn't we put the Twins and their owner, who's a billionaire, on the 2020 plan and end poverty now? A few seconds of silence, and then, of course, no response, just, okay, well, back to the issue we're talking about now. And so my initial reaction was, you know, if I'm glad we're going to take a serious look at it, and it does make sense to do it over a period of time, but I think it's an important point. If we prioritize something, we can do it fast. We have a bridge collapse in Minnesota, and less than a year later, the new bridge is pretty far along, and it's due to be done in December 20th or something, and the company gets an extra $200,000 per day. They're done early, up to 100 days early. I will guarantee you it's going to be done 100 days early. They're spending extra money to do it fast with more shifts and hiring more people, but when we decide as a society to do something, we can do it quickly. But let's go and say 2020 is good. If we can accomplish it by that time, we will have done what no state has ever done. But we have our first meeting last June, and go around the room, and every member, the 20 members of the commission, 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans, half from the House, half from the Senate. And we all talk about why we're on it, some of them just because they were asked to be on it, but yeah, they're happy to be on it. At least most of them seem to be satisfied with that, and they all talked about their thoughts about what the commission was to do. And it was a little bit discouraging, not surprising, but a lot of people, I don't really think we could actually really do it. Maybe we can help reduce poverty, but I don't think we could end poverty. And what I've been trying to sell is our task is not to prevent everybody from ever falling into poverty, because I don't think that's a possibility. If somebody is making ends meet fine and they get a divorce, overnight they may lose their housing, they may lose their income, they may be in poverty. They may have a fire burns down their house, it wasn't properly insured, or their apartment, and they're homeless. They may fall into poverty for a number of reasons, but our goal should be that if you fall into poverty, we're going to immediately help you get back on your feet again so you can be fully into society again. And that should be our goal, not that we can stop people from falling into it, but we can help them out of it right away. But a whole lot of the members said, you know, we could never do that. It was a bit of a defeatist attitude, which I frankly think is one of the problems with our political system and an issue I'm going to talk about in a few days. But we didn't start with the, wow, we're going to go and do it. We started with the, maybe we can do something about this. We hired an executive director for the commission, and his first letter, the draft letter, I grabbed it before it went out because I was concerned. He talked about, hey, you know, he has lots of hope because the commission 20 years ago, they came up with some good ideas out of there, and we actually passed some legislation. And I told him, you know, and maybe it'll make life better for people some. And I said, you know, you got to understand, that's not the purpose of this commission that you're in charge of. This commission has a charge of ending poverty by 2020 in Minnesota. It's not the legislative commission to make poverty a little less miserable for some of the people in it by 2020. It's to end poverty. And let's not start by selling ourselves short. So we started and went on several tours around the state because every community is different. The needs in small town Floodwood, Minnesota, where it's 30, 40 miles from any community where you can get a job that pays $8, $10, $12 an hour or more. And it's a town of 500 people and very low income town. And what you hear there is different than what you're going to hear in North Minneapolis or in my suburban district. You can hear poverty in any of those communities, but the needs are different there. There, when we heard people talk about the jobs they go to in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, 40 miles away, working $8.50 an hour, and you think about how much at that time, last December when we were up there, I think gas prices were significantly less than they were now, and you figure out just the cost of gas to get somebody there for an 8-hour job, 40 miles each way. When you're working at $8 an hour, you're losing an awful lot of your income to get a job there. So the needs are different there. And we heard all kinds of painful stories. So the trips were very successful. If we wanted to learn about poverty, Robert Kennedy in the 1960s had Poverty Tour. CBS did some specials on poverty in America, and it woke up a lot of people who didn't believe it existed, or they didn't know how much suffering there was that existed. One of my colleagues in the southern part of the state joined us for the tour in some of his communities, and he told people afterwards that he figured there were low-income people, but he didn't realize how bad it was. He knew they had a food shelf. He didn't know people went without food. Maybe they got, they needed food shelves to finish the month, but you know, they didn't really go hungry at any time. He heard from a 30-year-old woman who told a group of us that she was going to have 6 of her teeth pulled soon. She told me she thought it was kind of sad for a 30-year-old woman to be having, she already had some pulled, 6 more of her teeth pulled because she simply couldn't afford to go to the dentist. And you hear those stories, and everybody on a bipartisan basis says, that's awful. We heard, stories, things you don't think about, perhaps. One woman in northern Minnesota was telling us, you know what humiliation is when you have to go to a store and you've got food stamps to pay for your food, and you buy some, I don't know if you can buy pop with food stamps, I don't know what the rules are, but I think you can buy pop, and she said she was buying pop, then you'd go outside and try and sell it to kids and trade it with them for some feminine hygiene products, because you couldn't buy them in the store with food stamps. She had nothing but food stamps left that day, and she needed them, so she says she's going out and bartering with a teenage kid to buy tampons because she can't buy them with her food stamps. That tells you something. And one of the stories that really hit me was a woman also in northern Minnesota, impressive woman. She and her husband had about, I think they had either adopted or foster kids, about 20 different kids over the years. And most of them were special needs kids, a lot of them some fetal alcohol syndrome, other issues like that. And she said that she was, one of her goals for dealing with the teenagers was teaching them how they could be happy living in poverty. Because she said, realistically, they would never have a chance to earn enough money to get them out of poverty. I keep thinking, that's Minnesota, a state that thinks of itself as generous. We have people trying to teach kids how to live reasonably happy being poor because that's their whole future. And so we had a very successful time of educating. Almost all of the members of the commission went on, most went on 2 or more of the tours, and they did see something, and there's bipartisan consensus. We got to do something about this. But then you get to the hard part, which is where we're at right now. How do you get bipartisan action to do something about what we're trying to do? And I don't think if I could map out and suggest some proposals, and I'll ask some people for some feedback a little while on that. But if I mapped out what steps we'd have to do in order to end poverty in Minnesota, I think I could map out some. A lot of us could do that, but I don't think you could get bipartisan buy-in on a 20-member commission. I don't think you'd get 5 members of either party to buy in on majority of those recommendations. So how in the world are we going to come up with recommendations? What our legislative task is, we're required by law, no penalty if we don't, but we're required to come up with recommendations how we're going to end poverty in Minnesota, or how we think we should. And so I've suggested to the commission, instead of looking at everything through ideological lenses or what's politically realistic, look at our governor, look at our legislature, what can we pass? First of all, recognizing we've got 12 years to do it yet, And then looking at the fact that our job is not to pass it. We're 20 members, we can't pass any legislation on our own. Our job is to make recommendations on how we end poverty by 2020. So I suggest that we view ourselves as map makers. We're there to map the route that we could take, or routes if we want to do multiple options of how we do it, on how you could end poverty in Minnesota. You don't have to vote for the map if you're a map maker. You don't have to vote to say, I'm going to drive on that route, I'm going to take that route. All you have to do is say, here's the route that would get you where you're going. So I'm trying to say, let's have the vision of what society without poverty would be. And how do we get there? Let's map that out. And then next year we got the bigger task, or as big of a task, and that is beginning to sell that to the public, sell that to the legislature and governor, and start implementing it. Because, again, our biggest problem on an issue like this is defeatism. We have no chance of addressing the issue. Of course the governor wouldn't sign that. Of course the Senate and House wouldn't pass that. So we just sit here and do nothing? No, we're charged with telling people how to do it. And then the legislature can say, no, we're not willing to do that. But I think when you spell out what it takes, you're not going to get it all passed right away. But I think that we've got a chance, and if we've spelled out what to do, we have to move that way. And so far, there's been at least willingness to discuss that approach, and I think that's what we'll have to do, because as a co-chair of the commission, I don't really want to author a minority report. And I take it seriously when we're asked to make recommendations on how to do it. We ought to make those recommendations. So I'm hopeful that in the coming months we're going to come up with a plan that can work, and then we'll push for it next year. And I think we have some things going for us if we spell out the way this all works, and that is that it's actually less expensive economically, let alone other reasons you want to do this. It's less expensive economically to end poverty than it is to keep maintaining it or servicing it, helping people survive on poverty at a minimal level. Among other things, you have people who can contribute fully to the economy. If they're not worried about where they're going to feed their kids tonight, if they don't have to hang on to a job that they're not really able to do well because it has health care benefits. Greater Minnesota, we heard people saying they could not get a pay raise at work. They were paid 8 1/4 an hour or something, and it was time. They had been working there a year or two, and they were getting eligible for a significant pay increase, and they had to tell their employer they didn't want it because they lose the public health program they were on for health care. So it's a very lousy way to run an economy where you have a significant percentage of the people who are not participating in it, where you have a whole separate chain of free grocery stores for people who can't afford to, when you have people who are living in an apartment or home 1 month, and all of a sudden, because of illness or some problem, they can't afford the rent or they can't afford the mortgage payment for a few months, and all of a sudden they're out on the street. And you get people who do work. I've talked to people at one of the shelters in South Minneapolis about people who work at Toro in Lakeville, and they come home every night to the homeless shelter. And they have to get up really early because it takes a couple bus transfers to get there, and they have to be gone by 6 in the morning to get to their job by 8 in the morning. And then they come back to a homeless shelter at night. That doesn't build a strong economy. That's not a very efficient way of doing it. And when you look at the impact of crime and chemical dependency, all those issues multiply when you have a problem with poverty. So I think we should make the case that it's actually less expensive as well as more humane to address poverty the right way. So what I'm going to do now is spell out some of the things that we've been talking about, then open it up for feedback, because the one thing we've learned is it's too multifaceted approach for any one or any 20 of us to do on our own. It's not an issue for government alone. It's an issue for government and the business community and the nonprofit community and individuals. Every part of society has to kick in and do it. We've had ideological fights in politics for many years where some people in one party say it's not the role of government, it's private charities, the churches should do it. I don't know how the churches make sure you get paid a living wage. Churches might be able to staff food shelves and so on, but you divide the number of people in poverty up by the number of churches, and I know there's some mega churches, but there are also a lot of congregations of 200 people, and they're struggling to make their own ends meet without taking care of a number of impoverished families. But it's going to take everyone. It's going to take nonprofits, faith community, business, government. And so we're trying to spell out what it takes. And I've suggested that the way we might be able to view what we have to do is recognize that you're not poor if you have enough income to pay for your expenses. You got to get them in balance. If your expenses are up here and your income's down here, you're in poverty. But if you can pull down the expenses either by taking care of health care needs in a better way or making housing more affordable, that helps in bringing up income, either by higher wages or by tax credits, the earned income tax credits, a federal program. Most of our states add to it. So the lower your income is when you're working full-time, the amount you make compared to your family needs and size, you actually get income tax time. If you're aware of it, which not everybody is, you actually get a rebate. You get more money back than you paid in income taxes, sort of a negative income tax for people. It makes a difference and it helps people survive. But we can increase income either by higher wages, higher minimum wage, or whatever. You have to bring that up to match the other. You can also address other issues that have a very big impact, like assets. Right now in Minnesota, if you're going to be on medical assistance, you can't have a car worth more than $5,000, which may not be a problem, but the older your car, the more likely it is to break down, and then when your car breaks down, and you got to get the kids to daycare so you can get to work, you find out that you're missing a lot more work, you lose your job. We learned that the more challenged you have, the more problems multiply. So we have to work at building assets, not just economic ones, but allow people to save money so they can get down payment on a mortgage if they want to buy a house, so they can get the money to buy a car when the car breaks down, to have the money to repair it. If their kid gets sick, they have money to address the lost time at work because they're taking care of their child. So looking at not just increasing income, lowering expenses, but also building assets. Other types of assets might be very important. Not all of poverty is economic. You're lost. You're alone. Socially, you're isolated from others. You may not know how to do things wisely. Consumer education is important. Helping people have ties, some relative who can take care of their kids when their kids are sick, can't go to daycare. Variety of issues like that. And we have to look at the special challenges. Most people in poverty long-term have extra problems. They may be chemically dependent, they may have mental health issues, they may have both. They may have some physical or other disabilities that make them unable to work full-time at a job. We can see physical disabilities often, not always, but we can often see physical disabilities. We used to pity people with physical disabilities. Oh, feel sorry for them. Most people don't want pity, they want to participate, and we've learned very well how to deal with people with sight impairments, people who are in wheelchairs, people who struggle to work, they have some physical disability. We found ways to engage them and get them working. Same thing with people with mental health, but we don't do a very good job at it. So we're looking at a whole range of these issues, and before I wrap it up and open up for general discussion, I wanted to just see if people can throw out some ideas that they would argue are part of what we ought to be doing in terms of trying to end poverty. It's a really broad thing, and I'm not going to give more specifics than the ones I've given. I just want to hear if people have feedback, things you think we might be forgetting or things that you think are important that we might be remembering as well. Does anybody have
health care?
Go ahead over here and then.
I'm vice president of a homeless shelter in Moorhead, Minnesota, and the biggest problem we're running into are the legislative laws that we have to comply, and so we have to spend a ton of money in order to comply when we're not getting any money back.
You mean the ones for the HMIS reporting system?
Yes, the reporting system and all of the, and we don't get any money back, and so basically it's making it virtually impossible for us to broaden our work.
And I can go into that more later. There's some federal requirements, and the state agencies have put on more. And so every person who's in the homeless program they have to fill out lengthy questionnaires and forms to do in the agencies. I've been working with the Homeless Coalition on trying to ease that. My committee deals
Thank
with
you.
Housing, but it's a real problem, I know, but I understand it. That's a small thing, but it's a real piece of the puzzle. Who had the one over here?
Universal health care.
Universal health care. That's probably the biggest single aspect that we have to tackle. I've been working on that as a separate issue, but healthcare is number one cause of bankruptcy in this country, and it's not the poor, it's middle-income families who are insured, they have a big illness. Healthcare is the number one issue, yeah.
I was wondering, how does a business, big or small, set wages or salaries? I, you know, like, we have a brother-in-law that's a dentist, and I'm tempted many times to get in discussions with him without ruffling too many feathers, but I was wondering how he sets his prices, and I think he mentioned that he looks and compares with other ones to see. But is that really a, you know, if one raises it, then the other one raises it, and it just keeps on going up and up and up. I just wonder
how what kind of fair process we have for...
Yeah, how do you set a wage for a wage earner, for instance?
Our whole society's system of compensation is a little bit strange in terms of what I think most people would say it's out of whack in some of its priorities, but it's basically the market. If there's a shortage of dentists right now in Minnesota and most states, if one of them raises their rates, they all raise their rates and that's it. And then the fact that the state doesn't reimburse enough for medical assistance people on it, so dentists say they won't even cover it. So they're doing without. So it is, but when you look at wages, the people who do the most direct service for people, the people who work in nursing homes, changing bedpans, everything else, they're paid $8, $9, $10 an hour in Minnesota, often no health benefits. And you have somebody, I calculated last week, average NFL salary now is $1.4 million, which I calculate how many dollars it was for each minute of play. It's pretty astounding amount of money.
Now, we're in a town of 23,000, mm-hmm. and rent is, I'm sure it's higher up in Twin Cities, but 800 plus for an apartment of some kind. And I know that some of these people that we build houses for with Habitat, mm-hmm. they just can't handle it.
Yeah.
So when they get approved for a Habitat house, man, they're on top of the world.
Well, our income system, how we determine things, I mean, certain things we prioritize as a society. Entertainers, celebrities, athletes get paid very well. Even in our higher education institutions, most university presidents now get paid a lot less than the coaches. Is that because they're less important? No, it's just the reality of our way of doing it. But wage disparities are a big problem. Other things.
Over the past couple of decades, it seems like the Republicans have been really good at framing issues so that they catch the public conversation. And I feel like Democrats haven't been as good at that. And so they've been playing catch up in terms of framing issues in public. And one thing that I feel like has been lost is arguments made with a moral basis, like you're making in relationship to poverty. And I wonder if you'd comment about that dynamic of getting issues out there in a way that frame the issue differently. Like, for instance, the one that really burns me is tax relief, you know?
Tax burdens, tax relief, yeah.
Like, oh, of course I want relief for my tax burden, which the Democrats have laid on me. You know, that kind of framing really isn't moral, it's immoral, I think. But it frames a way of thinking that then people latch onto and that's how they think about it.
I strongly agree and would like to get into that. I want to just see if anybody had other points first. Well, let's get to that in a couple minutes.
Okay.
Remind me if I, back there.
Equalizing expenses per pupil on a statewide basis.
Yeah, a lot of states, Minnesota's better than some, though not that good, but a lot of states have very great discrepancies in how much schools have for funding.
Seems a bipartisan emphasis to reduce poverty that could work on government-business partnerships, where government can provide incentives for businesses to invest new capital in new technologies, green technologies that they're afraid to do now because they, you know, there's no payoff for it. It seems that Democrats and Republicans, you know, Republicans believe that the business sector is going to rise people out of poverty. Democrats say, well, okay, can government provide, you know, incentives for businesses to invest in?
That would be a key one in terms of how to do it becomes sticky, because, I mean, I've been opposing business subsidies from government because of the lobbying and so on.
Right.
We propose, we as a state were, may still do it, spending $200 million in public money to build a shopping mall, the Mall of America parking ramp, because it was going to create that many new jobs and so on. And the only thing we do in terms of what you're saying is we often will require them as a condition of that of paying so-and-so many living wage jobs and so on,
right.
Which if they fail to do it, well, that happens. But it is trying to get, again, business community has an obligation, and we as government have an obligation to work with them on it.
Adequacy of public transportation and availability to people who have no income source, so they're spending their money on public transportation.
That's a key one, and it's again, I mentioned Floodwood, southern small town in northern Minnesota, about how transportation there, but in metro areas, suburban communities, my state's one of the worst at doing that, but there are plenty of other states that have the same problems too.
There's so many different areas where we're wanting. Is it possible that maybe a good place to begin is to model our system after the systems that other countries have successfully fielded, like for example, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Switzerland, Germany, etc.
I think it's wise to look at places that have succeeded in addressing issues rather than like with healthcare. I think we look at what works anywhere in the world and take whatever pieces of that fit together and plug them in here instead of trying to copy other states that are failing to do the same things we're failing to do. But yeah, I think it is important to look elsewhere for whatever ideas. And do you have any particular one in mind you were thinking of?
Well, just a follow-up. If anybody who's done traveling in Europe, I've always been very impressed with the rail system. The few times that I have traveled, not knowing the system very well, if I make a mistake and take the wrong train or miss something, there's always another one coming along shortly thereafter to help bail me out. Also, as much as we maybe not like to talk about it, the disparity in incomes for that person who wants to spend his money on a $50,000 watch, okay. But again, we switch back to a very progressive income tax. This is the case, for example, in the Scandinavian countries. The income tax is quite progressive, as well as there being significant taxes on, say, an automobile that has an engine larger than, say, 1 liter.
I would agree with you. Tax policy is a key issue here. I mean, a lot of the money we spend as a government, when you're calculating the books in state government, you calculate how much we spend, including through tax credits, which the public doesn't see as spending, but like for housing, our number one subsidy for housing, in other words, money that's going to some people and not others, is the home mortgage interest deduction.
I was going to bring that one up.
Megabucks. I had a bill a number of years ago working with the Homeless Coalition on that would have capped the amount that you could deduct is $25,000 a year in interest, which is significant amount of interest that gives you $25,000. It was going to be houses that's nothing under it, any house under $500,000 in value, and so that still raised in our state a significant amount of money, $60 million, which we were going to then put into homeless programs. Mm-hmm. But the other issue on the tax stuff is some of the things like taxation to accomplish social goods, such as reduce smoking or drinking, or as you said, taxes on bigger vehicles that pollute more and use more fuel and so on. Those tend to be regressive taxes, so I think the way to do that is put those taxes in where we want them, and then every other tax, sales tax, doesn't accomplish any social good other than collect revenue, so we ought to be relying more on an income tax at least. But tax policy is a big one. Any other things you want to make sure we over here?
How do you deal with the argument that if you begin to have success, poor people from surrounding states will just move into Minnesota?
We've been hearing that for Well, as long as I've been involved in politics, we've been hearing, I remember once we had some people do some research because the Chamber of Commerce had put out some stuff on how we had lost all these jobs because of taxes. Businesses were fleeing to other states, and they calculated otherwise. 10,000 jobs had been lost the previous year on businesses going there, and our researchers would look at each of one they had listed on their list, and one of them was one company, 3M, was moving to Iowa. Well, they have plants all over the world, and somebody had called the Chamber of Commerce in that town because they couldn't find the 3M plant that had happened in the 2 years earlier or something. The person said, 3M? No, we don't have a 3M plant here. Well, 3M had talked about putting a plant there. It wasn't moving or anything. It was just talking about an expansion there, and it never happened. But that was listed as 300 jobs. Certain people have had that thing that, oh, our welfare is so generous. We give a mother our, what used to be the AFDC, the main welfare program, we give a mother and single mother and child, two-parent family, $437 a month. You said $800 a month for housing. And if you have subsidized housing, you lose another $100 of that. So that hasn't gone up since 1985. I don't think we're particularly generous. Some other states are worse, but we're always told people are flowing in. Our state demographer, I can't tell you what's happening this decade, but they can tell you what happened in the last decade from census data and so on. We did have more people below poverty moving into Minnesota than out, but that was only when you counted foreign immigration. If you took out foreign immigration, immigration between the states, we had more low-income people moving out than in, which Minnesota, we're a northern state. If you don't have a lot of money, it's not the best place to be in the winter. And but you can say that all you want. It's the reality is people believe what they hear many times, and they'd rather blame somebody else.
Rush Limbaugh said it.
Number one source of news for some. Anything else in
over here?
Yes.
Food prices.
Food prices, and that's a growing problem now. I mean, internationally, we're hearing from it. You have one?
Child care.
Child care is something we never adjust our economy for when we had half of the workforce that was staying home in, by and large with young kids. When that changed, wages didn't make up for it, and a lot of people would spend more with two kids in child care than they could make working at a paid job.
Of all the things I've heard, it would seem that the investment of business is the one thing that you have to look at here. Well over, I think, 70% of our nation's, of our government budget goes to entitlements. In the state of Washington, Medicare just has reduced its entitlement to physicians, health care providers, physical therapists, and whatnot, and reduced the number of visits, for example, that an elderly recipient can go to physical therapy. And they're not going to pay to go on their own. They're on fixed incomes. It seems that if we rely on government to the exclusion of industry, and I'm not suggesting that it's easy to get that investment of industry to buy into this, but I think that's got to be a big part of the answer.
Well, we certainly, government has been cutting back on health care benefits, as are businesses. I mean, everybody's cutting back on it because of the cost, and we're not fixing the problem, which is whole separate issue, but I think the important thing we have to do is, yeah, you're right, business is where the jobs are coming from. We have to make sure that we're spending money as far as government incentives and government policies to try and maximize that. One of the issues, though, getting back to what somebody over here said earlier, is our Chamber of Commerce says lower taxes is the way you get more business, and that's not statistically the way it works. The highest five tax states, which according to our Chamber of Commerce in Minnesota means they should be the worst off because they seem to want our policies to copy the lowest tax states like South Dakota and Mississippi and Louisiana, which we've been pulling down that direction. The five lowest tax states, every one of them is in the bottom 10 states in terms of per capita income after you paid those very low taxes. And likewise, the five highest tax states, every one of them is in the top 10 states in the income remaining after you pay those very high taxes. So unfortunately, in our debates in Minnesota, taxes becomes the one issue that helps business. I think there are 1,000 other things you can do to help, but that's a big factor. instead of continuing on with more of that now, just quickly say, and then open it up and get back to Chris's point, that I really do believe that we can move ahead on these issues. I think we've been lazy about our expectations. We accept the fact that we have homeless people, working people living in homeless shelters. We accept the fact that we have working people can't afford to pay the bills for health care or for food or for shelter. We found that acceptable that a 30-year-old woman has to have her teeth pulled because she can't see the dentist. And I think it's time, I think we are switching eras, and now is a good time to spell out a vision for where we want to go. And if Minnesota and other states decide we want to tackle these problems, I think we actually have the ability to do so. And we can build a better future. We used to be a can-do nation. I think we could be again if we have the political will to do so. And then I'll start out with the question discussion part with Chris's thing about the moral issue. Yes, we have let others frame the discussion, and for the last 30, 40 years, when I said self-interest and greed, instead of saying, do you care about senior citizens and want to take care of seniors in nursing homes, it's become very much more, who do you want to spend your money, you or the government? And the government is never us, even though it's a democracy. Government is them who are trying to steal your money. And I think talking about moral issues, the last 20 years or so, anytime you hear any matters of faith related to politics, you hear a Christian coalition, you hear a political right talking about a handful of issues. That's been changing in the last few years. I mean, I think there are plenty of people of faith who have been saying all along that, but the last 5 or 6 years, I've been getting lots of postcards and emails from people, often faith-based groups, saying, you know, not cut my taxes, but hey, let's make sure we have affordable housing for everybody in the community. And I think that's critically important that we do speak out and we do frame the debate on what's important. What are our values? Instead of talking about how we're going to deal with healthcare, what do we expect out of healthcare first? Do we want everyone to have access to being able to go to the doctor? Or is that not our priority? And I think if we spell out our values, people start out willing to go forward on it. So I think that's key. Whichever way you want to go with the discussion now, we got about 15 minutes.
Question?
Yes.
One parallel that seems between affluence and poverty is education. I've often thought that in the short run and the long run, it is going to be less costly to a society to educate those those that cannot afford it. So that they can obviously make their own way in the world rather than keeping them on the public dole. That was basically it.
Well, I'll make two comments on that. Three comments. One is the amount of debt students are working up for higher education is making it unaffordable. We had a medical student here last week who was asked a question or something, and I asked her how much debt she's accumulating each year, $60,000 a year. She said she'd have well over $200,000 in debt by the time she finishes it. And then they say, hey, we need more money as a doctor because we got to pay off all these debts. So a lot of kids don't get higher education because of it. Education is key, and you can see our priorities in our budgets. California, I remember it's about 10 or 15 years ago now, they made news because they were beginning to spend more money on their correctional system than they were on higher education system, whereas 20 years earlier it was like 3 or 4 to 1. They were spending 3-4 times as much on their prisons, on their higher education, colleges and universities, than they were spending on locking people up. Now that it's 2-1, they're spending more money on corrections than they are on higher education. And there might be a link between the two of them, but we got to address these dangerous people, we got to do this, but keeping them out of trouble, giving them an education, an opportunity, we don't seem to understand that. But the other point I make about education is, education is the number one thing we ought to do from a microeconomic point of view. How, if you are in poverty, the suggestion I should have for you and anything I can do to help you get more education is the answer. Because the more education you have, the higher level income you're statistically likely to have. And it's a reality, it works that way. The thing is, if everybody in Minnesota, if we made sure everybody in Minnesota got a four-year college degree, we got everybody in Minnesota advanced degrees, everybody in Minnesota had a PhD, we still have people flipping burgers at McDonald's, we still have people changing bed sheets in motels, and if those jobs are paying $8 an hour and housing in a cheap apartment is $800, they're still going to have people in poverty. So from a macroeconomic view, society-wise, we want to get people educated because it helps the economy as a whole, and it'll help those individuals get better jobs, but it doesn't address the poverty issue in of it itself. We have to do the education plus making sure the jobs pay a living wage, or we help those folks in other ways.
Yes. Forgive me for thinking this out loud, but it seems like, what about the issue of how do we acknowledge or address the fact that, like Jesus said, there will always be some people in poverty. That is, they might not be amenable to the tactics and strategies that most of us have used in order not to be in poverty, but to be wealthy. What's your thinking about connecting those people with very long-term situations where they're going to be taken care of? And how do you work the general public into that, as opposed to taxing governmental services and so forth? In other words, kind of an in-kind thing or a long-term contribution by individuals, businesses, or whatever, that will not necessarily involve the government from a financial or fiscal standpoint.
Let me make a couple of comments. First of all, I don't think the Christ statement, "You have the poor always with you," I don't think it means we're supposed to, that it, you have to. I mean, it just means that he was trying to say that's a long-term problem where I'm dealing with a short-term thing here.
Would you disagree with that some segment of that population is going to be there?
Right. I mean, there's some people who are going to need help, which may mean government subsidies. If I have very serious mental health problems, if I have, which may be treatable and maybe I can become self-sufficient, if I have a developmental disability and just cannot function at a job in a way that's going to give me enough income to take care of it, yes, they always will be. Matter of fact, we as a society don't expect everyone to work. We don't expect 5-year-olds to work. We don't usually expect 85-year-olds to work either. And so we expect to take care of some people. And the more we can take care of them through private pensions or Social Security or other things, the better. But we have to acknowledge that people, because of disability or whatever, can't support themselves. And we're either going to have to say, we don't care about you and you're going to just suffer, or we're going to help take care of you. And I think in a caring society, people want to take care of them. In terms of your other part of it, I think, if I'm understanding right, the other part of it was, what about using others to do it so it's not government? Well, I think as much as we can, one of the issues I've been trying to work on is find ways, and I would love to have, instead of just a simple minimum wage, which I think should be higher than it is, if it kept up with CEO salary since 1990, I think the minimum wage would be like $13 an hour. But it hasn't. And if we couldn't afford that because it would mess up business, I've never figured out why a business has to say, well, you know, if we paid our lowest wage workers more, we can't make it. But the opposite end at the top, you know, if we don't pay our CEOs enough, we can't make it, because we'll... I do think that we can require, in some ways, I think that if a business has employees and they're paying them a sub-living wage, in effect, the taxpayers are subsidizing their housing, their health care, and so on. And that maybe we should be requiring, if you're not going to pay your workers that, you have to contribute more to a sub-minimum wage, a sub-living wage pot that goes into these earned income tax credits. I think there are more creative ways of doing it than just simply, because I don't think the best way to do it is just public housing programs and so on. I think we should be doing more with trying to work up so businesses do pay a decent wage. And I think business has an obligation there, but they're not going to do it on their own. They need, whether it's incentives or whatever push, they have to have some push.
If I could just rebut that for a second. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a chain of possibilities.
Okay.
let's say that we know that it's very hard for someone to pay for gasoline to go very far. And in fact, if they're dependent on their car, it could be a problem because the car is not in low repair state and so forth. It's very old. So somebody like me who lives in the center of town, my wife and I have a 2,700 square foot house. And I could do this on my own, of course, but it's difficult for me to find my way through this. But if the government were involved at a level that didn't tax me more, but said, we have a service that we need, find somebody who has a job that is in town but has to live away in a cheaper place and so forth, you have a room that they could maybe live in. And we'll try to match you with somebody so that we've taken care of a number of issues. And if you would like to be an in-kind sort of contributor in that respect, or be able to take this person to the dentist once a year, for some checkup and so forth, and be able to diagnose the problems and even maybe go beyond that. And if you're besides that, not making this really sharp, right, but besides that, you're a retired person, and in fact, you could do child care for a day a week or something like that.
I understand. The one difficulty is, and first I'll say the difficulty, then what's doable. The difficulty is it's extremely hard. First of all, not that many people are willing to allow somebody to stay in a house. I understand, right, but I'm just saying that that's a reality. It's difficult to do. But having said that, there are efforts that try and do that. Okay. Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota actually had a share a home program. I don't know if it's still functioning, but they would try and take younger people, and it was tending to take older folks in homes, often living alone, and the younger person would contribute chores in the house and live in the house. It's very difficult to match people like that because to make sure it's a safe arrangement, it's a compatible arrangement, but there are efforts to try and do those, and there are plenty of nonprofits who are trying to get people who will drive people to the dentist and so on. The difficulty becomes when gas gets $4, the IRS gives reimbursement for volunteer mileage. I think it's 13 cents a mile.
Dialysis, too.
Yeah, for taking people dialysis is perfect. What you're saying is very important part of trying to plug things together. I think the easier way in some cases is that government could help with making that happen. Well, first of all, working through nonprofits to help them match programs like that. The other part of it is that if we can do more in terms of, drop my suggestion. I may come back to it. I can't think of it right now. Sorry, I had one comment. I'll make more.
You're talking about CEO salaries. Do you see a backlash coming? I mean, I'm hoping and praying, but do you see that coming?
I think the public definitely backlashes against it. I think the public very definitely has a backlash against it. But the trouble is the way our economy is set up, you have interlocking boards of directors where often executives from one company serve on the board of another one. And it's a crisis in terms of we're spending so much money. Our health care, we have United Health Group, a guy making $100 million a year who just provides zero health care. It's basically denying health insurance to a lot of people. But that kind of income, I mean, I don't care how much money people make. I just think that we should make sure that the people in the bottom are taken care of first, and our tax policy should be such that you can be very successful, great, but maybe you owe a little more to society to help.
Good question up here.
Yes.
Yeah, we live in Itasca County, which is in northern Minnesota, one of the poorest counties in the state. And one of the hopeful programs that's going on there is called Circles of Support.
Oh.
And it's a replication of a program in, I think, Ames, Iowa. And what they're trying to do is build teams of allies around people who live in poverty to provide them the networks that they need for educational support, financial support, transportation support. And it seems to me it's a long-term possibility to work with families, and the network in our neighbor is one of the allies. And she really, really has valued the opportunity to kind of mix networks. In a lot of small towns, it's pretty stratified. And this is enabled varieties of people with varieties of economic backgrounds to mix.
We'll get a quick, just a second, but I want to comment on that. Yes, Minnesota, there are several communities that have a surplus of support. It's run by the community action agencies, and they have like three community allies. There are people who are not in poverty linked up with one person in poverty. They meet once a month, once a week, I believe, and they do tremendous things. They can help the person if the person is, they give them hope if there's a problem with child care for them getting to work or a crisis. They help them through that. They've often helped them link with jobs. It helps not only the low-income person, but everybody who, the allies, learn more about the needs in their community, the understanding. I wish we could replicate that throughout the state, and that's one of the things we've been looking at. Very good program. We are running out of time. I'll take these two, and then I'll stay around for a while.
You know, we began by talking about universal health care. Virtually every health care provider I know acknowledges that universal health care is inevitable. But lately I've been wondering, how does that happen? Given the power and the strength of the insurance industry in America, which I think as a consumer and as a patient is driving up the cost of health care just by virtue of the multiple layers of those insurance carriers, how does that happen?
Politically, I've got a bill that would address that, and the insurance agent companies don't like it. And that's why it's not happening right now, though it's gaining support. Doctors and providers are sick of insurance companies telling them how to practice medicine. That's why doctors are coming around. The public is just desperately trying to get health care. I think the reason everybody's coming around to that is they see what we're doing. 31 cents on every dollar is going to paper or shuffling costs. That's a lot. That's $2,000 per person in this country each year now on administrative paperwork for health care. So I think we're trying to make it happen in Minnesota. I think we've got a very good plan. I'd be happy to talk with you more about it later or give you a link to it. But it's desperately needed. Healthcare is number one cause of poverty now. I'd make that case anyway. Last one, and then I'll stay around for more because we are out of time.
This isn't even a question, so it won't take long. But I think there's more to that scripture verse or the quote from Jesus about you'll always have the poor with you. It goes on to say, and anytime you want to, you can do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And the Bible doesn't tell us that the way we do it is by we put food in the food shelf. It doesn't say we do it by supporting government efforts to increase the minimum wage. It says we're supposed to take care of people. And it means each, not either or, it means both and. We have to take care of people any way we can. And I think that's a good point you made. Thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to stay around. Thank you.